morning, everyone. Welcome to the Power Hour. Alan Myers here, sitting in, keeping the mic warm. Glad to be here. Today, as normal for my style, I'm going to open with, in this first segment, some wackadoodle news. It's so crazy that it's out there, but got to talk about it. When we come back from our break, going to have a wonderful guest. His name is Philip Goodrich. He's written a book about the founding and quite possibly a secret history of the American Revolution. But let's begin with wackadoodle news. By the way, got a call-in number if you want to join the conversation. 844-769-2944. Again, 844-769-2944. This has been in the news for a while, and I want to bring it back up. It's about this $3.5 trillion, it's called Build Back Better legislation. Before I get into this story, and I may have mentioned this before on the program, but it's very helpful, I believe, to put $1 trillion into context. Almost nobody deals actually in trillions or billions or millions. As a number, trillion is one followed by 12 zeros. If you can, sit down, write that out. Look at how it's a monstrous number. I'm a numbers guy, but that doesn't really ring my bell. Next, it is said that a trillion is 1,000 billion. Still doesn't help me out. I decided to open up the spreadsheet, get the calculation done, and put 1 trillion into what I call understandable units. Seconds, inches, and miles. Remember, I'm only talking about 1 trillion, not 3.5. If you were to live 1 trillion seconds, a second basically being the time to snap your finger, 1 trillion seconds, you live to be 31,709 years old. Well, that's not going to happen. But that's 1 trillion. How about inches? Let's say you want to get some exercise and you want to walk 1 trillion inches. To do that, you'd have to walk a distance equal to 633 times around the Earth at the equator. One lap, 24,500 miles. You'd walk your entire life and still probably not get it done. Your last hope, miles. You want to be the first person to get that trillion-mile frequent flyer card. To fly 1 trillion miles, you'd have to fly a distance equal to 107 round trips from Earth to Pluto and back. That's unlikely to happen also, but that's 1 trillion. The legislation out there is promoting $3.5 trillion. Well, where's that going to come from? Forget what the legislation's about. Forget that it's a couple thousand pages long, and these people are voting on something that they've probably have never completely read or understood. Think about a document that's 2,000 pages long. If you could read full time day after day, how many pages could you read a day, and how long would it take you to read approximately 2,000 pages? Yet they're voting on this document. $3.5 trillion is absolutely astronomical. What puts this into context is that, and I may get to it later, is this is just going to add to the debt. And I want to talk about that. In this article, it says that the U.S. government spends more than it takes in through revenues. Now, I absolutely object to the use of the term revenue or revenues when it's associated with the federal government. Because what they're really talking about is taxation, and taxation is not profit making, it's profit taking. The government has no real sources of revenue. Well, maybe they get something for when you go to a national park, but I imagine it costs more to run the national park than it does with what people come in. So there's no net. What gets me is that how is this ever going to be paid back? And it was even said that by the president that there'll be no cost, and that somehow the cost of this legislation will somehow be paid off in the future by benefits. Well, that could possibly be what every administration has said every time they crank out a new bill that requires borrowing. Before we tag this on, don't we need to know really what it's going to be spent on and who is going to spend the time to read the 2,000 pages and produce the cliff notes so people can understand what our elected employees in D.C. are voting into the legislation? Crazy. Next one. You got to get an ID to show you've been vaccinated. But apparently, you don't need one to vote. And there's always this thing that some people just can't, they're unable to get an ID to ensure that our elections for everyone, not for one party or the other party, for everyone involved, that only those who are legally allowed to vote, because they're citizens, and they only get a vote once. Why is this so hard? If you want to drive a car, don't you have to get an ID? Yeah. For those people, God protect them, they need welfare benefits, they have to have an ID. How about to rent a home or rent a lawnmower? When you go, don't you have to show some form of ID so they know who they're renting to? Apparently, somehow, the only thing that doesn't really need an ID is one of the most important things that free citizens get to do. They get to express their desire, their opinion, in the voting process. That's what needs to be made safe and secure and, of course, accurate, the voting process. But apparently, you have to get an ID to prove you've been vaxxed, but you don't need to get one to show that you have the authority to vote and vote only once. I don't get it. Speaking of censorship, YouTube is cracking down on anti-vaccination content on its sites, and they've taken down several channels. Now, some of this information came from a representative of Google, which is YouTube's parent, and they are going after channels what they refer to as well-known vaccine misinformation spreaders. They list the names, Joseph McCullough, Children's Health Defense Fund, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and they want to go after any video content that claims commonly used vaccines already approved by health officials and the medical community that might be life-threatening or ineffective should be banned. Without getting into the in-depth on this topic, why do you need to censor or ban something? Why not just do the rational, reasonable, helpful thing for everyone? Have a discussion. If one person says one thing and another person says something completely different, instead of them letting them yell at each other from across the street or on one corner and somebody on another corner, why not invite the people, one on each side, multiple on each side, bring them onto a national stage. Have a moderator who will control the discussion so it doesn't get into name-calling, yelling, screaming, finger-pointing, cussing, and just go through the facts and let the facts be challenged by both sides. But that's not what we're getting. What we're getting is this is one bit of information. It has been decided to be fact, and anybody who disagrees is a misinformation spreader. This is the problem with censorship. It doesn't incur, it's as if you bring the facts to me and you bring them in a reasonable fashion and you allow both sides to communicate or three sides, whatever, I can't understand the end result. I can only be spoon-fed by media? No. This is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. We are being talked down to. We are being told we're not bright enough to understand. We're not bright enough to ask questions. And we don't really need to even begin to think to question the experts, because they, of course, would have no bad intent, and they only mean the best for us, and we just need to listen and follow along like really good sheeple. It isn't misinformation until it's proven, and calling it misinformation doesn't prove it. Only in a reasonable, rational, polite, respectful conversation amongst the people who are deeply in the know can we really get to what is the fact. Calling something that you don't like misinformation is just something that belongs on the playground. Continuing on, Janet Yellen. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, this just really gets me. She is in support of ending the debt limit for our federal government. No limit. Because she considers these hard caps on the amount of money, and I won't go into why that term is incorrect right now. The federal government is allowed to borrow is very destructive. She said this, I believe when Congress legislates expenditures and puts in place tax policy that determines taxes, those are the crucial decisions Congress is making, she said. And if to finance those spending and tax decisions, it's necessary to issue additional debt, I believe it's very destructive to put the President and myself, Treasury Secretary, in a situation where we might be unable to pay the bills that result from those past decisions. I would say this. Just because it's legislated doesn't mean it's correct. Doesn't mean it's good. The other is, let's talk about the debt for a moment. Because, like, trillion, it's just kind of accepted and it's not a big deal. I checked it out this morning before I came on air. Current debt for our government, for us, is over 28.8 trillion. Remember what 1 trillion is. A little history on the debt. it wasn't until approximately 1958 that the debt hit $1 trillion. In 1958 was the last time the debt decreased at any point in time year after year. Since 1958, every year, the debt has increased. In 1981, given that if you check the Treasury records, you'll find that the debt started in 1790. In 1981 is the first time the debt cleared $1 trillion. In almost the following 40 years, they've added over 27, now almost 28 trillion to the debt. Every year, it just keeps going up and up. Well, is that okay? Who gets to live their life that way? Well, that's one thought. The other thought to me is the federal government has no for-profit business. As I said, taxation is profit-taking, not profit-making. Yet it has a debt that it owes, but it has no for-profit business. This might sound familiar if you're familiar with Bernie Madoff. He had no for-profit business. He could have, but he didn't. And he eventually got put in jail for what turned out to be the rest of his life for running a $60 billion, that's an estimate, Ponzi scheme. A Ponzi scheme is where your investors, your lenders, believe they're investing in something wonderful, very profitable business venture, yet there is no for-profit business at all. Well, the federal government has no for-profit business from which to repay the debt, yet somehow it's able to continue to find more and more, newer and newer investors and buying their treasuries, their bills, their bonds, their notes. And the Treasury Secretary is saying, we need to end the debt ceiling, the debt limit. We need to let Congress just go wild, and somehow somebody somewhere will continue to acquire this debt. Well, like every good Ponzi scheme, you run out of new lenders, and then it hits the fan. That is one of my great worries. And to put this more personally, that is local to the U.S., who's one of the biggest holders of treasuries? Private and public pension plans. And how underfunded are the vast majority of these private and public pension plans? The vast majority. And that's without counting their treasury investments, because they had to invest in treasuries or AAA-rated investments. They had to. So they hold a tremendous amount of treasuries. And the treasuries aren't producing much in the way of interest or dividends, which is another reason why the pensions are underfunded. And they want to issue more. What's going to happen when they can't make the payday? One of the biggest buyers over the decades of treasuries has been Social Security, because every year Social Security would bring more funds in to the system, Social Security system, than would go out. Well, that changed last year, and now all those extra surplus that was used to buy treasuries, because that's the only thing they could invest in, well, now they're having to redeem those. And it's estimated by the trustees of the system that by, 2035, they're going to run out of the surplus, which means from now until then, the Social Security system will not be buying new treasuries. They'll be redeeming them. And The U.S. government is running out of one of its biggest buyers. Yet they want to keep upping the debt load on a massive, ultimately unpayable Ponzi scheme. This is what Congress thinks is their job. You need to let your people in D.C., that would be what I call the elected employees, you got to let them know they're not doing their job. We can't afford this. And if you're old enough, you may not care, but your children, your grandchildren, the future of this country may. We're about to go to break, so let me let you know who's coming after the break. The guest today is Philip Goodrich. He is a doctor by trade, and he is an amateur sleuthing historian. And his area of interest is the founding of America. And we're going to be talking about his book, Somerset, or Why and How Benjamin Franklin Orchestrated the American Revolution. Please stay with us. Remember, the call-in number is 844-769-2944. And if you have time, check out the Power Mall. The Power Mall is a great supporter of this program. And when you buy from them, you buy from the good guys. Alan Myers here, keeping the mic warm. Hope you've enjoyed a little piece of wackadoodle news. And when we come back, Philip Goodrich. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. When talking of great immune support, a line of products comes to my mind. That's North American Urban Spice. We carry the Resvital Calf, Sinuoraga, Oreganol Juice, Purelisi, Chaga Max, Collagen Power Plus, Oregaress, Super Strength Oregano Oil, Black Seed, and many more. Support small businesses when you buy from the good guys. Go to thepowermall.com. Or call 877-817-9829.
Hi, this is Catherine at the Power Hour. The Power Mall began when Joyce Riley discovered an all-natural soap that heals skin issues and can replace your bathing, laundry, and household cleaning products. That soap is Miracle 2 and is made from natural minerals and coconut extract with no added fragrances or colors and is naturally concentrated and biodegradable. I guarantee after you discover how amazing Miracle 2 products are, you'll recommend them to everyone you know. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today. You'll learn why so many people say, it's not just soap, it's a miracle.
Does Big Pharma have a hold of you? Thepowermall.com believes everything the body needs is provided by nature, unlike prescription drugs that aren't meant to cure but cover up your symptoms and contain addicting chemicals. Strauss Heart Drops are 100% all natural. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops by calling Jay at 1-877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com today.
The Power Hour has been in existence since the turn of the 21st century. It is more critical than ever for you to sign up for our free newsletter and our breaking news. Simply text the word Power Hour to 22828 on your mobile phone or sign up when you visit thepowerhour.com. Our website again is thepowerhour.com or text Power Hour to 22828. Together, our legacy will live on for centuries.
boost your immune system naturally this year with oil of oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that oil of oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Welcome back. I just like listening to that music, so sometimes I forget to start talking. Alan Myers here, keeping the mic warm. Welcome back to the Power Hour. Today, I am very fortunate to have a wonderful guest, Philip Goodrich. He is the author of the book that we're going to talk about, Somerset, or Why and How Benjamin Franklin Orchestrated the American Revolution, which was published in June of 2020. Philip, welcome to the Power Hour.
Thanks for inviting me. Looking forward to this discussion.
Absolutely. I'm a big fan of history in general, and I'm a big fan of American history, so it's going to be very interesting to get your take on this time period. What I'd like you to do first is to, because you'll do it better than me, introduce yourself. And then tell the story about how you got interested in this time period.
Sure. My name is Philip Goodrich. I'm a practicing surgeon, actually. I'm a general surgeon, been in the Kansas City area now practicing for about 37 years. I'd gone to Northwestern undergraduate and then to the University of Southern California for medical school, but I'm originally from Missouri, so really was coming back home for practice. I've got a blended family and raised six kids, and over the course of that time, two of the kids were always interested in going to bookstores back when we had such things. And in going to bookstores, they would always want to go to the children's section and then later the preteen section and look at books. And so that left me kind of in a lurch in the bookstore. And so I tended to gravitate to the closeout desks, seeing what little bargains I might find there. And about 7 years ago, I picked up a book, and I've since looked for it. I cannot find the exact title, but it was one of these little-known facts about the American Revolution or things you never knew about the American Revolution or whatever. And one of the chapters talked about a court case called Somerset versus Stuart. And while I've got a reasonable education, including college at Northwestern, this was a case that I'd never heard of, and they said it was a potential motivation for the American Revolution. Well, like all red-blooded Americans, as soon as I got home, I Googled it. And I was absolutely floored when I read the story of the court case of Somerset versus Stuart. I started pursuing it more in-depth and more aggressively, and this entire story started to unravel. That took me into the Hutchinson Papers, which were also considered to be a motivation for the American Revolution. And to my astonishment, there was a common link for both of those stories, and there's only one common link for those two stories, and that is a man that we all know his name. His name is Benjamin Franklin, but nobody knows anything else about him except that he's on our $100 bills, and they started post offices and libraries. So that sent me into exhaustive research on this, and 3 years later, I began writing, and the culmination of that is our book known as Somerset. There's two T's on the end of Somerset, otherwise it's the conventional British spelling. So there you have it in a nutshell.
Thank you so much. I had never heard of Somerset versus Stuart. I personally had done a little study myself on Benjamin Franklin. Quite amazing. He did not have an easy early life. He was somewhat indentured to his half-brother who beat him. And I guess, in a way, Benjamin got back at his half-brother James by writing Silence Do-Good Letters. And
yes.
His brother James,
was merrily printing these and had no idea that his apprentice was writing these and sticking them under the door after dark.
Yeah, he published 14 of them before he found out who was the writer. And Silence Do-Good was presented as a middle-aged woman who wrote about life in the colonies. So James was probably thrilled to have these, and when he found out, that's when Ben ran away to Philadelphia. So it's very every one of these characters is just interesting. But we're going to get into an area that I am completely new to, which I'm happy to go into. And Philip and I had spoken yesterday, and I learned, again, there are so many pieces to this puzzle that it strikes me that maybe our education system isn't everything that we think it is, because a lot of these gems are just not, they're not brought to our attention. And the first one, because we're going to get in, I want you, please, to start speaking about Somerset versus Stuart, who Somerset is, who Stuart is. And hold to the end the surprise of what kind of case this is.
Sure. Well, backing up just with Somerset, this is thrown into the book as an interlude. That's, you have to go through about the first third of the book. So for my readers, listeners, for the audiobook, you can go ahead and skip straight to this interlude if you want to, because it won't hurt your reading of the entire book. But I put it into that slot because that's about where the chronology is throughout the whole chronology of the book. But at any rate, James Somerset was actually born in West Africa, and as a child was taken aboard a slaving ship and taken to the West Indies, as almost all of the black African enslaved persons were, because they had to go through what was called seasoning, which meant they had to spend a year through the yellow fever season to make sure they didn't die. And if they survived the yellow fever season and picked up some English, they would take them then to the American mainland, where much higher prices were paid for enslaved persons. And so he was ultimately taken then to Norfolk, Virginia, about 1740. And a revenue agent from Great Britain named Charles Stuart purchased him at auction in Norfolk, Virginia. They lived there throughout the rest of Somerset's childhood and adolescence. And over the course of that time, Charles Stuart rose in the ranks of the British revenue agents until he became the supervising revenue agent for North America, with Somerset as his personal manservant. after the Stamp Act in 1765, things started getting kind of nasty all through the American colonies. And so Charles Stuart relocated with Somerset to Boston, where the military presence was felt to be a potential safeguard. It was a good idea, but unfortunately, Boston was also the hotbed of patriot discord against the British government. And so after about a year and a half in Boston, Stuart applied to the British government back in London and said, I've got to get out of Boston. I need a rest and recreation time for about a year back in London. And this was granted. And so he took Somerset with him, his personal manservant, to London. And they settled in for about a year, and Somerset was pretty much given the run of London to run errands. You know, he was in charge of the laundry and procuring the groceries and doing the marketing and purchasing clothing and pretty much taking care of Charles Stuart's day-to-day life in London. But you couldn't do that in London and not be subjected to the taunting of the free blacks in London. And because enslaved persons were becoming kind of a fad in London, all these enslaved persons were being taunted by free blacks for the fact that they were still enslaved persons. After a while, James Somerset apparently got his fill of it and ran away. This alerted Charles Stuart within about 48 hours when he hadn't come home, and Charles Stuart put out notices for the bounty hunters of London to find this young man that was his personal property, or certainly that was his perception. And ultimately the bounty hunters, it took them about 5 weeks, but they found him, and they brought him back to the home of Charles Stuart. At that point, they said, here's your man, as they called him. And Stuart just became belligerent. And he was angry that after having raised Somerset, he said, I gave you a great life, and this is the thanks you give me. I don't, you know, these people were tone deaf. And it never occurred to them, a great life as an enslaved person is not a great life. But nonetheless, that's how it was perceived in London in 1771. So at any rate,
Can I inject one thing?
Sure.
I love the history because it takes you, you're doing a great job taking us through these steps of this young man's life. And then, as you said, this perception by Stuart, look at what I gave you. Well, granted, he had clothing and food and housing. But what he didn't acknowledge was, look at the cost I charged you. I charged you your freedom.
Exactly.
And to me, when you say, look at the food I gave you, well, thank you. But you just stole my car. It's not a fair trade.
Yes, you just stole, you know, 20 years of my life.
Right. And, you know, so the perception that, okay, and it's possible from Stuart's view, he's going to say, well, I didn't beat you with a lash every day. Oh, gee, thanks for that one. That somehow by stealing somebody's or maintaining their loss of freedom, liberty, rights, by just, you know, giving him food, shelter, and whatever, that's a fair exchange, and it's not. And I just wanted to bring that up.
Absolutely. And hopefully your audience is picking up on this, that it's like, what is this Charles Stuart talking about? But at any rate, so Stuart said, I don't want him. I want you to load him on a ship, take him to Jamaica, and auction him off as a slave. Well, that sort of thing would have essentially been a death sentence, because going into the heat of the Caribbean during the sugar harvesting season for a man who was working as a house servant would have been overwhelming, and he probably would not have survived the year. At that point, London abolitionists stepped in, and they filed a writ of habeas corpus, and they had Somerset released to their care and to their directive. And they filed suit at the Court of King's Bench, which is essentially the British Supreme Court in London, to have this man set free because it was illegal in their eyes, in the eyes of the abolitionists, to direct a human being to be taken away out of the British Empire for auction in the Caribbean. This opened up an entire can of worms in the London court system. Ultimately, the abolitionists retained two of the sergeants at law, who were considered the top attorneys in Great Britain, to plead the case of Somerset. And the West Indies planters, who were the plantation owners in Jamaica and Barbados, likewise retained counsel, including the Solicitor General of the British Empire and a future Attorney General of the British Empire. So Somerset's abolitionists then retained another future Attorney General to support the sergeants at law. So he had five of the biggest hitters in the entire British Empire in terms of law pleading this case of this one enslaved black African man at the Court of King's Bench. And of course, that's getting attention all over London. It's like, what in the world is going on in this case?
For me, what this brings about is, and I'm so glad you've got all this deep history and knowledge, is that this is one case because of one event, which would seemingly not be that big, but now you're at the highest court in the land. And when I was first learning about this, what surprised me was that this actually took place in Britain and not back then in the colonies. But whoever's involved knows how heavy this one little case is. So as you just said, they're bringing in the biggest of players, the smartest of people,
exactly,
to attack and defend this case.
These are dream team players on both sides.
They're what?
And they are letting out this is a dream team of attorneys on both sides, and they are letting out the stops. And, you know, at that point, Lord Mansfield, the Chief Justice, decides that he wants two associate judges with him because he doesn't want personal responsibility for adjudicating this case. So now this would be considered the case of the century if it were taking place in the 21st century. You know, this would be on TV every day. And
it'd be everywhere.
Yeah, and normally in the Supreme Court of the British Empire at that time, most cases were judged within 15 minutes. This case drags on for 6 months.
In your study, because I think this is also key, which you brought up, you've got a judge who apparently sees how massive this case is, and he asks to get two associate judges. How often, if you know from your study, how often would this happen?
Probably less than 5% of the time. This would have got, like I said, this would have gotten attention from the attorneys at the Old Bailey in London. They would have all been saying, something's weird with this case. Something massive is going on here. And as we had talked about previously, Lord Mansfield was working behind the scenes with the abolitionists for his own purposes. He really wanted to address this issue of chattel slavery in the British Empire, and he was personally
very opposed to it, but as the Chief Justice, he felt that he had to support it because of the rule of law. So he was a very conflicted individual. Now, tragically, he kept notes of all of his cases, and tragically, those notes were lost 9 years after the Somerset decision. They were destroyed in a fire.
Oh, geez.
But as so often with history, there's so many things when I research this that, I wish we had that. Boy, I wish we had this. But that's part of the problem for the professional historians, is that some of these things really have to be pieced together as best we can with what we would consider informed conjecture. But this is good information, because during the course of this 6 months, yet a new attorney appears pleading for Somerset, and he's a young man named John Allen. He is accepted to the British Bar on May 8th, and on May 9th, he is in the courtroom pleading for James Somerset, 24 hours after he was accepted to the bar. There's something strange in this part of the story, and the something strange in this part of the story is this young man is the great-nephew of Benjamin Franklin.
At this moment in time in the case, where is Benjamin Franklin?
Benjamin Franklin's been in London at that point for the last 3 years, but a lot of people are unaware. Benjamin Franklin, in that time frame, lived about 25 out of 30 years in Europe. He spent very little time in the United States. He spent most of his time in Europe, and probably two-thirds of that time was in London. So he was very familiar with the London abolitionists. He knew most of them personally. He had two of them within his own inner circle of advisors about the American Revolution. And so he was getting good inside information. And so all of a sudden, his great-nephew shows up as part of the dream team, speaking in favor of James Somerset. 1 month after all those pleadings are made is when Lord Mansfield makes his final declaration, and his final declaration was that, yes, indeed, James Somerset must be set free.
I think it would be absolutely, as you said, to have the notes, first of all, that the judge took notes, to have them and to see how he was able to deal with his personal and professional internal conflicts and render a judgment that freed a human being.
Yeah, we've got some reasonable explanation for this. There was an attorney at the time named Capel Loft, who sat in the Court of King's Bench on an almost daily basis writing the notes regarding the actual decisions as they were being rendered by the justices of the Supreme Court, because, oddly enough, there are no court records of any of this that are official. What we have is we have Capel Loft's notes on this, including all the statements that Mansfield made in court at the time of the pronouncing judgment. So that still survives, and that is where most people quote Mansfield's statements about the black must be set free. That all comes from Capel Loft. Above and beyond that, we also have in time statements made by the abolitionists regarding the case, as well as why they were interested in having this man set free. The abolitionists believed that if one enslaved person was freed by the Court of King's Bench, the Supreme Court in Great Britain, it would automatically produce abolition throughout the empire. Of course, that was a gross overread on their part, but that was their belief. Lord Mansfield himself said, that was never my intent, but that was certainly the way it was received in London. And in London, on the heels of that decision coming out in 1772, supposedly over 5,000 black African enslaved people were set free within 6 months voluntarily by their owners. They said, oh, well, we're not supposed to own enslaved black Africans anymore. And they just released them. So that was certainly the take in London.
Hold that thought for a moment, because we're going to, we got a hard break in less than a minute. So I'm just kind of waiting for, I didn't want to cut you off in the middle of a sentence.
That's fine, but your audience is going to want to know what the repercussions were in the colonies.
That's why they're coming back. hold that thought. Remember where you're at. Write it down if you need to.
And I've got it.
For those out there, this is the Power Hour. And we will be back after some very important messages. Remember, if you want to buy from the good guys, you buy at the Power Mall. We'll be right back after these important messages. Stay with us.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Hi, this is Jay at the Power Mall. I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.